great training ground for anybody who has a chance to become a photographer for a newspaper, because one day you're shooting food, the next day you're shooting in the studio, the next day you're shooting a fire, the next day you're shooting sports, the next, you know, it is the best training ground ever for a photographer. But one of the things you end up shooting a lot of is headshots, you know, people holding their food, people behind their desk, people in front of a computer. And if you don't try to make it a little bit more than just a headshot, you go crazy. You have to, it kind of forces you to rethink everything every time you go do it. You can't treat it as the same thing over and over again.
Hey, welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast, brought to you by CloudSpot, the easiest way for photographers to deliver and even sell your photos online. I'm your host, Raymond Hatfield, as always, and each week I interview one of the world's most interesting photographers to learn what it really takes to capture beautiful images and compelling stories so that you can start to do the same. Today we have an episode from the BPP Vault. You know, after interviewing world-class photographers for years, we've built up quite a rich library of photo tips and tricks that guests share to help you get better at capturing amazing images. So with new listeners finding the show every day, these rewind interviews allow for new listeners to discover those gold photo nuggets of the past, while also allowing long-time listeners to revisit and hear an interview with fresh ears and more hands-on experience to draw from. In today's interview, we are chatting with Rob Tenenbaum, who is a headshot photographer from New York. You know, Rob has a really diverse background in photography, started in photojournalism, which provided him with this broad range of experiences, including shooting foods, portraits, you know, sports, and then whatever the news is, a fire, who knows. What I really loved is that his diverse background contributes to his adaptability as a photographer, which he talks about, allowing him to handle, I mean, various types of photography genres effectively. Now, I have three main takeaways from today's episode. The first one is just to be open to exploration. You know, in Rob's journey from experimenting with various photography styles during college to the importance of being open and exploring different approaches, trying out different genres and techniques can help you to discover your true passion and unique style as a photographer. Takeaway number two was that passion drives excellence. Regardless of the educational path that you've chosen, being passionate about photography is essential to becoming a skilled and successful photographer. You know, passion fuels the desire to learn, which fuels the desire to experiment and just continually improve your craft. And takeaway number three is to connect with your subject. As Rob notes in this episode, and you're going to hear, establishing a rapport with your subject is essential, especially in portrait photography. Making your clients feel comfortable and at ease during a photo shoot can lead to more genuine expressions and authentic portraits. Being approachable, communicative, and attentive to your subject's needs can create a positive and memorable experience, which in the end is just going to make for better photos for you. You're really going to love this one. With that, let's go ahead and get on into today's interview with Rob Tenenbaum.
Oh, gosh, my earliest memories of photography are my cousins, my older cousins coming to visit. They lived in Massachusetts. They come down to visit, and they're always competitive about everything, but they all had cameras and they were trying to outshoot each other. And this is back in the film days. So rarely would I ever see the results, but they just seemed to be having so much fun with their cameras and, basically trying to outdo each other. That was my first spark. It just seemed like it was fun. And so my parents got me my first camera, and it was a 110 camera. It was a teeny little negative, and it was like cha-chunk. You need to advance the film, click cha-chunk. The results were magic to me. It was not the best quality in the world, but I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, it was an automatic camera, but just seeing results, you know, at that point it was bring the film to the store, wait for a few days for it to be developed. Then you get back your prints, and not everyone was exposed correctly, but the ones that were, it's magic to me. It still is. Even digital photography is still magic.
So you were a child at this time. This was, these cousins were older than you.
Yeah. I think I was maybe eight or nine when it kind of sparked in me. Not that I carried a camera with me everywhere. Not that I even at that point had dreams of being a professional photographer, but I think when the question came up as I got older, what are you going to do in a few years? What's your career going to be? Sometimes I kept it to myself. Sometimes I told people, you know, I really like photography. When I got to college, finally, I took some serious courses and it just all clicked. I was shooting, you know, black and white for class. But they made you try everything, photograph still life, photograph people, go out and just shoot found stuff, anything that looks interesting, look for the light. And it just never stopped being interesting to me, being in the dark room, printing and developing your own film. I mean, I keep coming back to the word magic. To me, it is. I mean, there's obviously a science behind it. As you get more into it, you learn the science behind it. But there'll always be art and magic to it, no matter what stage you are, whether you're just starting or, you know, doing it for years.
Yeah, I'm interested though why you felt like you had to hide that you wanted to be a photographer.
Because I didn't know anything about it. you don't want to claim, you know, what's your reason for wanting to become a photographer, or what makes you think you can be a photographer? And just like any field, before you actually have any real knowledge of it, it's just your passion. It's just your interest. It's just your fascination with it. So, not knowing, there's books about photography. There's no book that can tell you here's day one and here's day 360. Sure. And here's where you're going to be at that point. So, the only thing that you can rely on is your passion and just continually doing what it is you love until at some point you look back and you say, my God, I'm actually, you know, I'm doing this.
So from 9 till, let's say 18, you know, before you go off to college, would you say, looking back, that you took more photos than the average kid? Or was it just that the photos that you did take meant something to you more? What do you think? What was that like?
I'm fortunate that my parents didn't throw out my negatives or didn't throw out my prints and stuff. And once,
so you still have them?
What's that?
You still have them?
Not all, but I have a lot, and I have a lot from college as well. But now that I have my own kids and they're curious to know what I do for a living, and I'll dig out my pictures from when I was their age and show them, you know, what what I was capable of at the time and why I liked particular pictures and what I was, you know, what I was experiencing. And part of it's just trying to compare their experiences, you know, what life is like for them in 2019 compared to what life was like back in 1979, which blows my mind. and then I look at them and, you know, obviously there's nostalgia, but there's also, like, you know, I look at it from somebody who's been shooting for, I mean, you said 15 years. I've been shooting for 25 years professionally, you know, making my full-time living for more than almost 15 years. But, I'm just happy. I'm very proud of that 9-year-old boy who did what he did. And, again, didn't carry my camera everywhere, but it was important to me. I was the family photographer when we went on vacations. You know, I made sure to capture moments. It wasn't until later when I got to college that I went off in the journalism side of things and did photojournalism, newspaper photography, went away to graduate school for that as well.
So then let me ask right there, because when you had decided to go to college and you had made that decision, I'm going to study photography. I didn't go that route. So is it that you had to declare, you know, I want to study photojournalism? Because earlier you mentioned, you know, some still life, some black and white stuff. Did they give you some freedom to test out what you wanted and then focus on that specific thing? Or did you have to make that declaration in the beginning?
Well, I went to a liberal arts school where they had all sorts of different specialties you could major in. There was no photography major. I didn't go to a photography school. I went to a liberal arts school where I definitely wanted to study journalism. And photography, it just seemed like this natural fit for me, telling a story. So sorry for the brain glitch. I'm trying to think back that far. And there was, we had really good professors. There was only a couple of them, and they let you pursue what you wanted. You had to do the required assignments, but they let you pursue the particular avenue you wanted to. So they said at the end of the year, do this, do a project that you want to do. So I tended towards the storytelling, the photojournalism style photography, where some people may have done still life or whatever, as long as they were looking for somebody at the end of the year to be technically proficient, you know, understand composition, that kind of thing. So there was a lot of freedom. And I, the one thing that was really the clincher for me was they did bring in an adjunct professor. And this woman was a photojournalist, and her name was Sue Dooley. And she just happened to be the wife of the director of photography for Newsday, which is the newspaper on Long Island at the time, had a circulation of this. It was the fifth or sixth biggest newspaper in the country. So I loved what she did. She appreciated what I did, my enthusiasm. And one thing led to another. I got the internship at Newsday, and that was it. From that point on, my career kind of just went from there. So don't, it's not necessarily what you study. It's what you pay attention to, who you surround yourself with. Again, if that woman had never shown up, maybe I would still be where I am. But, you know, I don't burn bridges, and I try to learn from everybody I meet. You know, some people you learn a little bit from, and some people you learn a lot from. So my professors at the school were great. And they knew how much to push you. They knew how much to lay off. And they could tell when you were putting in an effort. So, and then that's the important thing. You know, it's not enough that you get a grade. It's enough that you earned your grade. So.
Yeah. And that's something that I always wondered, especially now, maybe just cause I'm younger, but it's, you know, there's the shift towards kind of moving away from formal education, you know, specifically college, you know, maybe not so much like a trade school. I had went to film school, so it was just all about film for cinematography. So I didn't go to a formal 4-year college. But the people who I've talked to who have gone to that 4-year college praise, you know, have so much praise for it. Do you think that having that formal education, that structure, really helped, or I guess, how did it help form you into the photographer that you are today?
Yeah, no, again, it's the passion. 4-year college, I could have gone to Maryland. I went to this school called Hofstra. It's on here on the Long Island. Actually, I ended up settling about 15 minutes away from it. I applied to a number of different colleges. I didn't know what I wanted when I went to college. So 4-year college is great if you show up, work hard, play hard, and use the degree that your parents or all the loans paid for. I mean, but again, Pat, whether you're an accountant or a photographer, what, you know, be passionate about it. That's all I can say. I mean, I can, some people just took it as an easy A or an easy B or whatever. They just didn't, you know, I know those people, they came and went. But it was the passion of the people. It was just a few of us, who really took it seriously. We had, again, had good teachers. A 4-year degree kept me, you know, I was able to do things like the journalism side of things, which at the time was more important to me, or as important. But an education is important. I understand what you're saying about not being, there's a lot of people that didn't go for the formal education anymore. You know, some people rely on YouTube videos to get everything on. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, as long as the person presenting the information to you is presenting the correct information. Because there's a million different ways of doing things, but there's always a wrong way of doing things and a right way of doing things. And the, one of the best things about the 4-year education or getting taught in person is the in-person is to having that instant feedback. And so again, so not to jump too far forward, but when you become a professional, you know, unless you surround yourself with other working photographers, it's hard to get that feedback that you necessarily would get. So I think everybody, or at least the photographers I do know, you know, we kind of plateau at some point. We're kind of like, we want to break into something new. And all of a sudden we're in that, we become beginners again. Like, yes, as a still photographer a few years ago, wanting to get into more video because digital SLRs allow you to shoot video also. And it was the most painful, not maybe because I was getting older and I wasn't retaining information as much, but I mean, it was uncomfortable, but you know, I plowed through because, you know, I was passionate about it. So same thing with learning photography. I can still remember losing whole rolls of film and just my ruining, it would just kill me. Absolutely kill me.
When you say ruining whole rolls of film, you just mean the way that it was shot, or you accidentally opened up everything. The back?
You know, I didn't have the settings correct on the camera. My shutter speed was completely off. And this is the days where you couldn't chimp on the back of your camera. Sure. So, you know, it was press and pray. I mean, you know, you think you got it right. You had your light meter and, you know, this is, and black and white was a lot more forgiving because, you know, it was all a matter of intensity of light. It wasn't about color temperature or anything like that. You know, it was either, you know, your shadows were too dark or your brights were too bright. But you know, there were times where I had did a bonehead move. I mean, there was one of my first assignments for Newsday when I worked there as an intern. It was one of my greatest lessons. One of the editors sent me out to photograph. Sent out me to photograph a politician, and the guy had, you know, was busy, and I was hired as a photography intern, but I by no means was I ready for like prime time. I was like flying by the seat of my pants. I was still learning as I was going, and I show up, I photograph the guy. I thought, oh, that went pretty well. And then when I get back to the office, I develop the film, I show it to the editor, and he's like, why is this in black and white? We were shooting in color at that point. He's like, we need color. We can't, you know. So after some uncomfortable silence, you know, he said, I'm going to call this guy back, and you're going to go back there, and you're going to reshoot this thing, and you're going to apologize profusely for wasting this man's time.
Oh, no.
And what a great lesson it was. I mean, and just, you got to get things wrong in order to get them right. Sometimes, you know, it was again, another uncomfortable situation, but I never made that mistake again. At that point, it's like showing up with a digital camera now, not having a card, memory card in the camera. Yeah. So,
oh man,
it happens. That's the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of want to explore a little bit more of that idea of, you know, of shooting and, you know, finding out that your whole role is wasted, or going back to those days where you had just that 110, it's all automatic. At some point you move past automatic and you start learning the technicals of photography. When it came to that, was there anything that you remember being difficult for you to understand from the technical aspect of photography?
Yeah. It's like juggling and trying to ride a unicycle when you're first starting out. I mean, you know, you're dealing with, if you're in a situation, a studio, say, a very controlled environment, and you have studio lights or whatever light source you're using, and it's just a constant light, it's not a flash, you're not worried about the intensity going up or down. That's a safe environment to learn. It's when you start, you know, so then you can adjust your shutter speed and your aperture and you can play around with it and see the results. But when you're outside and suddenly the clouds are coming in and out or the subject is moving, or, you know, when the variables start to happen, everything you learned in the studio really just goes out the window. And those are my earliest, you know, memories. It was trying to create a catalog in my mind of, here's a situation, what do I do? That's when you start moving into, I think that the first thing you start moving into is shutter priority or aperture priority. You start to try to limit the mistakes that can be made. The cameras are great. They're very intelligent. But when you start to think, you know, this situation calls for shutter priority, or this situation calls for aperture priority, then you start moving away from letting the camera make all the decisions. And that's an important place to be, because then now you're saying, well, I know I wanted a shallow depth of field, so I shot at, say, 2.8 on this still life, but I'm getting all this light that's like yellow coming in from the window, and the light I'm using in my studio is getting a blue cast. How am I going to change that? So possibly it's the shutter. If I speed up the shutter, it'll kill some of that light coming in from this source. And you start to, you know, put those things together, and especially with color photography, or when you're shooting sports and you're like, you know, everyone's blurred, you know, why is there so much blur? So you put it into shutter priority, and you make sure that you're always shooting at a very fast shutter speed to freeze the motion, if that's the look you're going for. And then you decide what, you know, aperture. If you put in shutter priority, then the aperture, the camera is going to figure out the aperture for you. And you can learn that way. And again, when we were starting out with film, if you didn't write, you know, keep a diary of every exposure that you made, which was nearly impossible when you're out in the field just doing stuff. If you were doing still life, absolutely. A great way to learn what shutter, what aperture combination makes what result. But now with digital, you have no excuse not to pay attention to what the settings are. They're right there in your file information when you bring it into whatever it is, Lightroom, Bridge, Photo Mechanic. It's all there. You can learn a lot faster if you it's right in front of you.
It's funny that you say that. This past year, I started photography by shooting film. I went to film school and I shot video using film. But this year, I really had more of an interest back into film. Bought myself a medium format camera. You know, I started using my light meter a lot more than I had in the past, you know, 12 years, I suppose. But even still, I find that as a struggle because I've become so used to taking a photo, coming back, having the settings right there, that if something was wrong, I knew exactly what I needed to do to fix it. But now shooting on film, there's no data. There's no data except for just the light. And you look at the photo and you think, I wish I remembered what my shutter speed here was, because I would have loved to have got more, you know, detail or more color saturation in the sky right there and bring that down. That's funny. I have a whole notebook around here that was just full of. And then, of course, I screwed it up because I have two different backs on my camera that I was switching between stocks. And then so I'd write down like first frame is this, second frame is this. I screwed up the whole thing. Totally my fault. Oh, well. I mean, luckily, it wasn't like commissioned or anything like that. But the whole learning experience part of that, I wouldn't say that it went out the window because now I know how to better document my photo.
Right. Mistakes are great ways to learn.
A very expensive way to learn. But yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So let's talk about headshots. Where did headshots come into this whole equation? You started off in photojournalism. You went that route. Today, you're shooting a lot of headshots. Where did that come from?
College, photographed a lot of everything. By no means did I make any decisions at that point other than the journalism side of things. And then when I got into journalism, again, shooting a lot of everything, but you're on your own, you're getting feedback that if you didn't do it right, they're never going to send you out for another assignment. So you better get it right. And working for a newspaper, I'm just as a little aside, very sad that industry is suffering as much as it is. It's great training ground for anybody who has a chance to become a photographer for a newspaper, because one day you're shooting food, the next day you're shooting in the studio, the next day you're shooting a fire, the next day you're shooting sports, the next, you know, it is the best training ground ever for a photographer. But one of the things you end up shooting a lot of is headshots, you know, people holding their food, people behind their desk, people in front of a computer. And if you don't try to make it a little bit more than just a headshot, you go crazy. You have to, it kind of forces you to rethink everything. Every time you go do it, you can't treat it as the same thing over and over again. So the most difficult thing I think I dealt with, was photographing people, because at that point, not being as experienced, you're trying to maintain a conversation, put the subject at ease, and then not look like you have no idea what you're doing with your equipment. So I made it a priority to be a better people photographer, not even portrait photographer, but just, you know, whether it's somebody in their environment, you're documenting them doing whatever it is they do, or you're actually, your sole purpose is to have that person look into the lens and you're trying to capture a little bit of who they are. You want to get past, I wanted to get past the the technical part of it and just literally be having a conversation with somebody and just happen to be taking pictures. I want that's the environment that works the best for me. I'm not a very controlling person. I still look for moments when I photograph people. But when I started out, it was like, oh, hold on a second, look at my camera, or getting people to pose, or, you know, it was a struggle, but it took a lot of stuff that didn't look all that great when I look back on it to get me to where I am now. But again, working at the newspaper allowed me a lot of opportunity to shoot. So I know a lot of people don't have that opportunity. So my only suggestion is just grab your neighbors, grab your friends, grab your pets, grab mannequins, grab, you know, whatever it is, and play with it, you know, ask people to pose, to turn it. And, you know, part of it's the light, part of it's the subject. I'm convinced that anybody and everybody can be photographed well. It just comes down to making them comfortable and making sure the light's flattering for their particular body type. And yeah.
Hey, Raymond here, and we will get back to today's show in just a moment. You know, if you want to photograph people, you know, families, portraits, weddings, engagements, you know that the elephant in the room is posing. You have a pretty good understanding of how to use your camera, you know how to make a pretty picture, but when somebody steps in front of your lens, well, imagine if you knew how to make them look their best and feel confident. That is what you can do when you understand basic posing techniques. So I want to give you access to my free posing guide over at photoposingguide.com. There are 9 different categories and more than 80 real example photos of poses that you can use for inspiration to rock your next session. Once again, you can download your free photo posing guide over at photoposingguide.com. Now, let's go ahead and get back into today's interview. I think that's definitely going to be one of the memorable quotes from this episode. Anybody can be photographed well. I love that. That's hard for a lot of new photographers to get their head around, because I think as you start in photography, you feel like, oh, I have an understanding of how this camera works. But when you get a person in front of it, it's not the same relationship that you have with a camera, and it's very easy to take bad photos of people. And I'm proof of that. I have plenty of bad photos of people that I've taken, and it's very easy to just say, oh, I don't like portraits. I don't like shooting portraits. You know, I just stick to landscapes.
Right.
Yeah. That's very interesting. I feel like that's something that I'm going to think about for a while here. So thank you for sharing that.
Okay.
When it comes to headshots, when I think of headshots, I've never had a headshot taken aside from just like a friend. You know, I needed a photo for something, you know. So I think of a headshot, I think of maybe a social media profile picture, or, you know, LinkedIn, something professional, businessy. All of these things, the way that I see it, is just one photo. So when you go and you do like a headshot session, when you're going in for headshots for somebody, is that the goal, to get that one photo that they're going to want in order to deliver? Are you ready to transform your love for photography into profit? Imagine capturing beautiful moments while bringing in a little extra money for your family each month. Sound too good to be true? With CloudSpot, it's not just a dream. Designed by photographers for photographers, CloudSpot simplifies your business. Effortlessly organize shoots, send professional contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and enjoy faster payment payouts with the lowest fees in the industry, including PayPal. Forget lost emails and messy spreadsheets. CloudSpot offers a streamlined workflow, letting you focus on the moment. And here is the clincher. Grab your free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com and you'll get access to my personal wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires. So don't let uncertainty hold you back. Embrace the future of photography business management with CloudSpot Studio. Sign up at deliverphotos.com today and transform your passion into profit.
Majority of the time, yeah. You definitely want to come away with, one good photo that represents somebody they want to be seen. LinkedIn or, on a company's internal website, that kind of thing. It shows up on their signature at the bottom of their emails. But once in a while, I've been fortunate enough to move beyond that, and companies like Pricewaterhouse, Citibank, American Express, there's some of the clients I do work for where, we have this executive who was just promoted. We need a new head, portrait, not headshot, but portrait. And I try to make sure that people understand the difference, because headshot really is it comes from head and shoulders, a headshot. But when you move into the area of portraiture, you can still be shooting head and shoulders of the person, but you're really trying to do something more than just flat light. Here's the person. You want to bring a little bit more to the composition, whether it's how you light the person, how far you back away from them and include the environment. That's more portrait photography. It's not just one light or two lights. Sometimes it's, four or five lights. So the question again was,
is it that one photo or how much of a variety is it that you're trying to shoot to deliver?
It's funny. I mean, whether it's somebody who's, the office secretary or the CEO, everyone kind of has to go through the same poses. So I shoot, it's something that's like almost automatic at this point. I can look at somebody, and this is something that you just develop over time, doing this over and over again. You look at somebody and you can tell their comfort level. You can tell, their body type, their ability to hold a pose, their ability to smile. You can tell that that's part of what moving beyond the technical and just having a conversation with somebody, I can pretty much tell within the first 30 seconds to a minute how I'm going to handle this individual. Some people, I'm done in 2 minutes. I'm not going to get anything more out of them. They're not happy to be there. they're just doing this because they have to. That's one kind of client. And then you have the person who thinks they're a model and gives you way more than you need. And you have to kind of bring them back down to earth and talk quieter, get them to pay attention, get out of their own heads of what they think that they're going to look like. And then you have people that are just naturals and they're very good listeners and they're going to do exactly what you ask. And also a very quick shoot. And then you have people who are difficult. And the first thing they say when they walk in the room is, "I don't photograph well. I hate having my picture taken."
Oh, jeez.
And it happens, and it's okay. And it makes me smile because I'm going to get your picture anyway. and I'm going to do my job. If you don't do your half of the bargain, you're going to be the one who ended up with a bad picture because of you. So I make it light. I make it as light as possible. And some people can't be moved. They can't be meant to smile. They don't want to offer a smile. And not that it necessarily has to be a smile photo, but as soon as you have somebody smiling, they're going to be a partner in what's going on.
How many photos would you say that you take during a traditional headshot session?
So here's the funny thing. When you're photographing 50 people in an office, you've got a limited number of time.
Of course.
So again, having that experience with shooting people, knowing you're seeing a person, you know what you're going to get out of them, you still make a move pretty quickly. I always start straight on. And we're talking just head and shoulders here. And then you do certain things on the left shoulder, and then you do certain things on the right shoulder. And then it's just a matter of, bring your chin more towards camera, bring your chin, further from camera, give me a little tilt. But I was, I'm always coaching people along the way and making sure that I try not to keep both hands on the camera. I actually try to shoot with one hand so they can see my mouth while I'm talking, and I'm smiling the entire time, and it keeps people focused outside themselves.
So that to me sounds more like it's a posing thing right there. Once you get the shot, there's no need to take more. Just move on to the next sort of pose. So I'm assuming, two dozen photos per person.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you. Yes, that's what we're getting. But yes, I mean, rarely. I mean, there are times when I don't. Literally, somebody has me come in to photograph their entire office, and you can shoot 20 frames. You can shoot 50 frames, but I want to shoot 10 frames that I don't have to cut down to, or, you know, 20 frames that I don't have to cut down to 20, to 10. So, and again, it comes with experience. It comes with, having done something over and over again, a lot of times. And you have to be very conscious about it. You know, you could easily shoot 50 frames in the same amount of times you shoot 10 frames.
Sure.
But you're going to have a person who's blinking and like rubbing their eyes. on a similar note, I can be brought in to just photograph one executive and, still shoot just 10 to 25 frames. One reason is I don't want to keep them from what they're doing because they're busy. So it's more of a mental prep ahead of time. If I can do a site visit, I do a site visit ahead of time. I try to get as much advanced knowledge, what they like, what they don't like. When you're dealing with their executive assistants, you know, they're pretty good about filling you in on personality things. So I can kind of mentally prep myself for that. The other side of the things is back, you know, to shooting 50 people in an office. Nobody has a luxury of time. Nobody has a luxury of giving it all. You hope the people show up with their makeup on, you know, and a good attitude. I mean, so again, it's not quantity, it's quality. When you're photographing your friends, your family, pets, whatever, then that's the time you get to learn. When you can, you have the luxury of time and examining everything you're doing. When you show up, somebody's paying you to do a job, you gotta look like you know what you're doing, do it efficiently. And I think part of the experience is just having a good attitude. My favorite feedback is that, it was painless. You know, that people, you know, I connected with the people and they had a good experience. They don't necessarily say it. They love their photo, but they talk more about the experience that they were provided, that they felt comfortable. It's their favorite headshot they've ever had. To me, that means everything. They're not going to tell me, oh, you know, the umbrella was huge and it was in the perfect position. And I love the, you know, they always talk about experience, you know, and that's the important thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because you mentioned there the, you know, you want to make it look like you know what you're doing. And it's funny that as somebody who's been shooting for so long, you still feel that way because sometimes I feel like, what am I doing? Like if I have this feeling, is there something wrong with me inside, you know? But then you also brought up the, you know, making those micro adjustments, like, you know, turning the head a little bit this way, left shoulder, right shoulder, doing these things. Are you doing these different adjustments more of that way of making it look like I know exactly what it is that I want, I'm going to go for this look? Or is it, how much of a difference do these, I mean, seemingly to me, such small adjustments really make to the final outcome of a photo? And how are you making those decisions?
Wow.
Yeah, that was like a 7-part question there. So if you of it, I'll be excited.
No, it's a great question. Is one, again, I hate to fall back on the, it becomes automatic after a while. I think everyone when everyone looks at anybody's portrait, you know, or headshot, you know, it's good or not. For one reason or another, the lighting is good. It puts the person literally in a good light, or the pose is pleasant to the eye. You know, I've seen, you know, the worst poor headshots ever. And nobody told the person it was bad. I mean, or the photographer was horrible and the person who had their picture taken had no idea what a good headshot was. So they just accepted it. But I'm pretty sure that 99% of the people out there, you know a good headshot when they see it. And so one of the things I tell people is when I ask them to choose their picture is, you know, hopefully I've given you enough choices and I know what I like and here's what I would prefer, but I need you to give me your input because what I would say is a really good picture, you may not find, you know, to be a great picture of yourself. So that's one of the reasons I shoot so many subtle, you know, moves, tilts, you know, just very, very subtle, you know, different changes in body position. So that when a person goes through, like if I shoot 20 frames and I edit it down to 10 and give that to the client to have them choose, that they're going to see enough variation so that they're going to say, you know, they're going to go from 10 to 5 to 3 to 1, and they're going to be like, that's the shot. So regardless, people will tell me, they'll come in and they'll say, I hate my left side. I only like to be photographed on my right side. And I'm like, okay, I get it. We're going to photograph you on your preferred side, but let's photograph you on the other side. You might surprise yourself. Maybe you'll see something you never saw before. Part of me is, and I always say while I'm shooting, is I want to give you as many options as possible. I want you to feel like, you know, it wasn't just one and done. So it's, part of it is just to make the client feel good. And part of it is legitimately, and to, what you see through the camera sometimes translates differently to what you see on screen, you know? So let's give people, even if it's just a quarter of an inch of a move, sometimes the light falls perfectly. It's just the perfect expression. So it's not just head movements, it's smiles, no smiles, soft smiles, broad smiles, intense stares. I mean, you know, it depends on the person. If a person comes in and they're very smiley and it seems to be their personality, I know I'm going to get the smile. So I'm going to be like, so I try to bring them down, not emotionally, but bring the smile down, you know, bring the smile down a little bit and give them something they may not necessarily thought they were capable of.
I had never thought about it that way. I had never thought of delivering something to somebody that they might not see in themselves. You know, I had always looked at it as, I had always looked at those minor adjustments as the photographer's way of, like, I always thought that I was missing something. Like, what are they seeing that I'm not seeing? But I never thought about it from that client's perspective of seeing, you know, because I've seen photos of myself that I think that I look good. And then I see the photo and I'm like, I look like trash. And then it's also the exact other way around. So that is again, it talks about that experience. And I think another part of the client experience is always like what comes next, right? So we have the lead up to it. You try to get information from, say, a secretary of an executive's preferences. You go do the shoot, say that they had, oh, this was so great. This was a great experience. And the next is that delivery process. So when it comes to delivering photos, I'm used to delivering, you know, close to 1,000 photos for a wedding, right? It seems substantial.
Yeah.
When it comes to delivering headshots, what is that delivery process like? Because oftentimes this could be the last interaction that you have with somebody. Is there anything that you do to make it special, to stand out for them?
Hey, Raymond here, and I know that diving into the world of editing can feel like navigating a maze, especially if you're just starting out. So that's why I created our exclusive collection of 52 Lightroom presets, absolutely free. While presets can dramatically enhance your photos, they're not a one-click solution. They're a starting point for your creativity and an opportunity to learn and grow in your editing skills. These presets work seamlessly with all versions of Lightroom, whether you're on a computer or using Lightroom Mobile. And they're designed to simplify your editing process, adding that professional touch to your photos while giving you the flexibility to fine-tune them to your taste. So if you're ready to take your photos to the next level, head over to freephotographypresets.com right now and get editing today.
One of the first questions people ask after the session's over is, do I get retouching? And I try to, whoever organizes the event, or if I'm dealing with one person, you know, I try to get as much information to them, ahead of time so that there's no surprises. But say on one of those 50 to 80 headshot days, you know, 50 different people I'm photographing, I'll try to explain to everybody. I'm going to give you, so there's two ways of, well, let's go back a little bit. There's two ways of delivering. One is I do the shoot, I edit it down to the best, say 10 pictures, and then I create a proof and as a PDF, and I email that directly to the person who I photographed or to the person who organized it. They distribute those. Then conversely, the person chooses their favorite images for retouching, gets back to me directly or to the person that organized the event. And that person gives me back those choices. And then I go ahead and I do the retouching. and then I deliver back a high res file. One of the first things people ask me after the session is over is, do I get retouched? And they get very excited about that. And then they
so weird.
Proceed to tell me about all their perceived flaws and things they hate about themselves. And I tell them, I'm an expert retoucher. I'll do all the retouching. I always do it myself. I don't send it out to another service. Tell me if there's anything you can't remember right now, when you look at the pictures, the proof, make a note of it. Give me all your suggestions and I'll take care of everything. But as far as that, I mean, that's really the biggest part of it after shooting is the retouching and then delivering it back to the client. And we also always just discuss the specs. You know, I try to, if there's a company protocol for file size, file dimensions, I try to get that ahead of time too, but typically a business portrait, unless there's a request otherwise, I give back to people as a square and also as an 8x10 square. You can plug right into LinkedIn.
So you're delivering multiple versions of the same photo, multiple sizes, aspect ratios, and even file types, perhaps?
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, JPEGs are pretty much standard, unless somebody needs something otherwise.
Is it just something as simple as a Google Drive link? Here you go. Enjoy. Have a great day. Or is it something? Is it something more substantial? As far
five years ago, a DVD, CD, thumb drive. But nowadays, everyone's pretty. You know, some of the larger companies have firewall issues with Dropbox and some of the delivery services. But even those, you can kind of get around with. There's other services where you can send a link and then they can download entire folders. So typically nowadays it's Dropbox for me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I'm very, one of the key things too, when you become a professional is being organized. If you're not organized, you're going to fail hard. So, I mean, I make sure I put everything into a file structure. I'll give individual folders for each person that was photographed so that they're labeled and the person that I want to make the experience with my contact person is so simple that they go with anybody else who's not organized. They're going to, call me back immediately. My whole mantra is just keep it simple for the client.
How do you think that sets you apart from other photographers? How do other photographers make it complicated?
Just not answering questions before they're asked. I try to answer as many questions because I've done this so many times. I've gotten all the questions and I've learned the hard way with some clients and they never called me back because I messed up. And that's what happens along the way. Not that they didn't get a good product, but I dropped the ball somewhere along the line. So having learned from good experiences and bad experiences, what clients need and want, I have a flow to things. And I try not to leave any question unanswered, whether they asked it or not. I'm always communicating with clients, trying to get what their expectations are before a shoot, what their expectations will be before, after a shoot. We're supposed to be the experts.
Sure.
So they're relying on us. They kind of know what they want in general, but we're supposed to be the one with all the answers. You know, when they say headshot, well, we say, well, do you want that on a neutral backdrop? Do you need colors specific to your company's colors? Do you need an environmental headshot? Do you need, and then I'm never shy to ask them, do you have any examples of images that you have? And if you're going with a different look, what's the reason you're going for a different look for everybody? Send me bad examples. Send me, what you're trying to avoid. And nobody, again, just same with digital cameras. You have no excuse not to, know what your camera's doing, from a technical standpoint. Same thing, we have email now and you can attach pictures. You can text people. I mean, there's no excuse for having poor communication nowadays because everybody's available 24/7. So, and that's, I also try, not that I try to be there 24/7 for clients, but there are times when I'm getting questions and I make them a priority, but,
yeah, I would imagine that that's also a big part of it, especially dealing with corporate clients. You know, they oftentimes have a question and they need an answer right away before decisions can be made moving forward. So I totally get that. Now some listeners, you know, are probably more listeners are experienced with something just like traditional portrait pricing, where it's, you know, this much time, this much dollars, done, you know, and then that's it. Corporate headshots, business executives, feels to me a little bit more high volume than just like a family photo session. So how is pricing different for corporate headshots than it would be a traditional family session?
The old model for portrait sessions was you knew you're going in to get prints done ultimately. And that's family photography is still pretty much like that. And now in the 21st century, it's, you know, prints are not the priority anymore. And for businesses, it's just about content. So our LinkedIn pages need to have a consistent look. So we have all of our employees here next Tuesday, come in, photograph everybody on this such and such a background. And then we need retouched files. And so I structured around my time, the number of people that are being photographed, the budgets of some companies. I mean, there's no maximum on what I'll charge, but there is a minimum. I mean, to make it worth my while, I have to charge a minimum amount. I mean, I live in New York, you know, the New York area. 90% of my clients are in the city. In order to provide the service I provide, I have to charge a certain minimum amount. So whether you have one person or 50 people, you know, there's going to be a certain amount I'm going to charge.
Just real quick though, how finite does that get? Is it like between, for every person, there's a certain additional charge, or is it 1 to 10 people, it's this much, 10 to 50 people, it's this much, 100 to 200 people?
The latter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What you're saying. So yeah, so it's a sliding scale. One of my clients, a law firm I shoot, they bring me in fairly often. They're a really big firm. And we established when I first started doing the work for them that this is the amount I'm going to charge. Let's say it's, I think it's like $300 a headshot. But some people, you know, may say, no matter how many people I photograph, it's going to be $300, whether it's 2 people or 20 people. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that's good business. And nobody's going to become super rich unless you become famous as well as a photographer. So let's just be good business people. So that client, if they, you know, for every person they add on to that, I'll start ticking down the price. And then there'll be a minimum, like the least I'll charge them per person is say like 150. So if they have 50 people, it'll still be 100 and, you know, the minimum kicks in at some point. Mm-hmm. Some companies, it's just going to be, a real simple come in, photograph them on a neutral backdrop. Everybody gets the same look. You know, it's a volume thing. I want them to bring me back. I know there's one company, a financial company I do work for. They have a very young staff. They hire people right out of school. It's the first job that a lot of these really smart kids are getting, but some are only going to be there for a year. They're going to get what they need and they're going to move on to their next company in the industry. Financial industry has a lot of turnover, people moving from one company to the next. So almost every 6 months on cue, 80 people need a headshot. and it's not because it's a bad company. It's a good company. It's just that, again, these people are young and they have their idea of what they want. They either stay for a few years and then they move on. So anyway, I basically say, if you shoot between 50 and 70 people, you know, here's the, I'll charge you like $50 per person. Mm-hmm. It's real simple. There's no crazy modeling, and they're in their 20s. They all look good. They don't have to do anything. They don't need makeup. They don't need, you know, they're all young and handsome and gorgeous. And so there's less work for me to do on the back end, not as much retouching. So again, it depends on the company. I wish there was one set price for everybody. You know, there's probably a few handful of people in the world that can say, you can't get me for less than $1,000 a person. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of those. I work within companies' budgets. But again, there is a minimum. I'm not going to travel to the city for a $50 headshot. Or even $150 headshot. But if it's local, I've mentioned on other meetings, I use a service called Thumbtack. It basically helps you get not just photography jobs. If you're a plumber, it helps you get plumbing jobs. But as a photographer, it helps you locate near people nearby, far away that need photography. If there's somebody that's 5 miles away, I'm not going to charge them what I would charge to go to the city. I'm so happy not to have to get on a train or drive over a bridge. I will do a headshot for $100 or $125. One of the reasons I will is because I love doing what I do, and any day shooting headshots or an event is so much better than digging ditches or whatever, you know.
Right. Digging ditches.
So sometimes it's a business decision, sometimes it's a personal decision, but when it comes to big corporations,
that's how it works.
Pay. They can pay, so I have them pay.
I, as I said, I'm totally oblivious to the whole world of more volume photography. So that pricing model is completely foreign to me. And I appreciate you kind of sharing the those nuances there. There is a lot of things that I would think that it would make sense to have like one set pricing, but the way that you talked about that, makes a whole lot more sense than I would have imagined. And I know that those listening had to have got a lot out of that. So thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit about lighting, because photography, as we know, lighting is very, very important stuff. And you, as a professional working photographer, probably bring more lighting gear to a headshot session than I'd probably do to a wedding. Where do you suggest those who want to start shooting headshots start when it comes to buying lighting equipment? What do they need? Like, what are the basics?
Basics. All right. One light is good enough, but better yet, get two lights. Now, I'm not recommending any specific brand, but if cost is an issue, you know, don't worry about having to spend tons of money. There are tons and tons of great pieces of equipment out there that, you know, won't break the bank. For a long time, I shoot Canon. So I was using 580s or the 600 series, whatever I have.
The Canon branded flashes. Canon
mm-hmm. flashes. There is several Chinese companies that make knockoffs. They're almost identical. They're not going to last as long, or, you know, I don't trust them. I've never bought them, but they are very similar in as far as I mean, they're almost identical. They work yeah. TTL. The buttons are in the same places, and they're half the cost. But beyond just having a flash, if you decide to use flash, you need modifiers. You need umbrellas, soft boxes, those type things. There are a million different gadgets out there to help modify light. For a long time, I was using a lot of silly modifiers. And then eventually I came back to umbrellas. Umbrellas are just terrific. Little umbrellas, big umbrellas. The main thing though, I do is I get one that you can take the backing off so you can shoot through it. You can put the backing back on it and bounce into it. And you can also, the most important part for me is the diffusion cloth. You can put a layer of diffusion between the light bouncing off the inside, and it goes through a diffusion cloth and then obviously onto the subject. It's versatile. Sometimes I don't know what I'm getting into when I go to an office. I have a big umbrella if they have high ceilings. I have a smaller umbrella if they have low ceilings. And if they have no, you know, really low ceilings, I bring a chair so they have to sit down and I can get my light higher than the subject. Sometimes it's not, you know, the lighting gear, that's the most important thing. It's you get into a situation where you're not prepared. So I just try to be prepared. I travel as light as I can, bring as much variety as I can. So that depending on the situation, you know, there I've gone to some offices where they had virtually no room to move in. So I end up using window light as like a second light source, like right now over your shoulder. I can see right now there's a little bit of that rim light there. Mm-hmm. That works great. You have a two light setup. As far as I'm concerned, that's a wonderful two light setup. You got the main light off to one side and you got your rim light over there, and that works great. That's a really good place to start for headshots. But then when you get into lighting styles a little bit more, you might want to try something that's a little more glamorous, like a clamshell, where you have especially for women, it's a little more flattering, is you get one softer diffuse light above the subject straight over. So you get a butterfly under the nose, and then you have another umbrella or diffused light underneath. That's not as strong as the one up there. So it kind of fills in the shadows a little bit, fills in the shadows under the eyes, fills in the shadows. And more importantly for a lot of women is women that don't have extra chins think they have extra chins. You want to get rid of the shadow mm-hmm. under the chin there. And that's a wonderful light too. And then you can start, you can have that one light here, and then you can start adding other lights and getting, rim lights behind, the sky's the limit. You can go crazy and do a super number of lights setups. But
so when you show up, then how do you make that decision? Say that space isn't an option or isn't a problem. How would you approach it?
Well, again, going back to answering questions before they're asked, I try to get as much information about the look that the particular company is going for, so I can have that set up in mind. And I do ask. I ask them, are your ceilings, how high are your ceilings? And some people have never thought about that question in their entire lives. And all of a sudden they're like, oh, I really don't know. And I'm like, well, give me an estimate. And that way I'm prepared. I bring a chair if I have to, so that people are sitting so I can have my light higher than them. Cause I've been in so many offices when I first started out, especially, I didn't ask that question. I'd show up and, suddenly I have no way of getting that light any lower without it being like directly on them. And it just, it doesn't work for a lot of people. So again, ask questions, but ask those questions ahead of time. But when you don't have the benefit, when things do change, I've come to complete agreement with somebody about the picture that they're expecting to get. And then I show up, oh, that conference room can't be used. We have to go in this different part of the building. And that's when, you start sweating. Just even though I've been doing this for years, I still start to sweat a little bit. I'm like, all right, what am I going to be up against? What am I going to have to do to make this happen? And, odds are you can make it happen. Mm-hmm. If you can't, then you just have to explain to them, well, here's what happened. The room that I expected to work in is not, we have to use a different room. Here's what I have to change some things. It's rare, but it happens. And again,
usually pretty understanding of that. Like if that's the situation.
Yeah. Most mm-hmm. times.
Time. I would hope so. I mean, if it's out of your control, you can only do so much.
It's amazing what you can get away with. And you just smile and use please and thank you and all that.
Yeah. That's great. So before this interview, I was looking at your website, and on your About Me page, it says, you say on your website that you bring, quote, the best professional equipment with you to your shoots. Now, I know that many of those listening probably, they're new photographers, probably don't have access to real professional equipment.
Right.
As somebody who doesn't have access to real professional equipment, are they still able to take acceptable headshots? And if so, what should they do to focus on getting the best results?
Yeah. The old saying, at least in the news business, is the best camera you have is the one you have with you. So everybody's walking around with an iPhone or a Samsung, whatever. Everyone's got a camera on them nowadays. So from that standpoint, no excuse. You can take a picture wherever you go. If you're moved up to an SLR, again, that's the camera you have. Make it work for you. You may not have the best lenses. If you can, invest in better lenses. The body is not as important. But that being said, if you have not the top end, you have an acceptable camera that works. I would say it's absolutely possible to make professional quality images with what you have. It comes down to the pilot, not the plane. So, make sure that you, if you're passionate about it, just keep shooting and learn from your mistakes. When you don't get what you want, you've just gotten experience, and learn from that experience to ultimately get what it is you want from the pictures that you're shooting. And the first thing when people ask me for advice, oh, I love to take pictures. How do I become a professional photographer? Well, what do you like to photograph? Some people, they like to photograph everything. When I was starting out, I liked photographing everything, but I was totally intimidated by photographing people. So I made it a point to do what made me most uncomfortable, so that some point in the future, it wasn't the most uncomfortable thing in the world anymore. It was just another tool in my kit that when I was put in a situation, it wasn't something I had to stress out about. So when I say that on my website about having the best, most professional gear possible, I think I wrote that because I'm not going to say I'm a Nikon shooter. I'm not a Canon shooter. I'm not going to put specific bodies because there's always a new camera or lens coming along. I just want people to see me as a professional. When I show up and I have the camera that I have, it's not a question, they don't know. Some people are like, oh, is that a Canon? This and this and this. Oh yeah. Blah, 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 blah. But 90% of people are just like, oh, it looks like a professional camera. Yeah. They don't have to question it. So it's not necessarily what you have in your hand is how you use it. If you show up with, a 5D Mark IV and you don't know what the hell you're doing, what's the point of having the 5D Mark IV?
Yeah.
You get comfortable with it, shoot with it. If you're going to say you're a professional headshot photographer or professional sports photographer, you got to walk the talk. That's all, I'm very proud of the pictures I have on my website, but that website is already 2 years old. And I look at those pictures and I'm like, I have so many other pictures. I'm so busy. I got to update those pictures. I've got to update my website, but,
got to find that time.
Some of those pictures were shot with the 5D Mark IIs, 5D Mark IIIs. Now I'm shooting with 5D Mark IVs. It's when you look at my pictures, I'm hoping you say, well, he shot that with a really good camera. I want people to say, that person looks really good, or or it just looks professional. So to me, it's a camera is a tool. It's a hammer. My job as a photographer, I'm going to get the picture I want. I'm not going to show up and twirl my camera around and say, this is the best camera anybody's ever going to use.
Yeah.
It's in the results.
So then let me, I don't want to rephrase the question, because I think that you answered the question that I had very well, but maybe thinking about it from a different angle. And this will be my last question, because I know that I've kept you longer than I said that I would. But what is something that anybody listening today, maybe they just have that entry-level camera, right? Maybe they just have a phone. What's something that they can do today to take a better headshot?
Well, when you're all first starting out, everyone's going to be coming from a slightly different level, but it's really – you just can't shoot and then say you're done. You really have to look at your work. And I still do this as a professional. I look at everything I've done from a particular job and I see what I could have done better. And I think what you can do is, it's one of the things that my professors encouraged us to do 25 years ago, is look at a lot of magazines, look at a lot of websites, see what you think looks good, even what you think is bad, and then try to duplicate, particular looks. Before you can be yourself, you have to kind of be somebody else in photography. You have to kind of emulate other styles, and then eventually you'll find your comfort place, where you feel like you're seeing things the way you like them to be. So, but as far as headshot photography, if you're not a people person, don't become a headshot photographer.
So maybe that's it. Maybe just learn how to interact with people before you pull out the camera.
I think it's important. I'm an introvert. I got to tell you, I mean, when I'm not shooting, I want to be home and hanging out with my family and not going to parties or whatever it is. That's part of being 50 years old almost. But when I'm with people, I feed off of them. If that's your personality, where you meet somebody and you can find something interesting in them, and you know, you could be a portrait or a headshot photographer. If you're not, then look at landscapes or look at still life photography, because photography itself is just such an amazing gift. It's there's an outlet for every type of personality, you know. You know, for me, I'm comfortable in a lot of different fields. But for me, what keeps me coming back to portrait photography is meeting the people, meeting organizations, helping individuals and organizations present their best self. Because literally headshots are usually the first impression that an outside person sees of an individual or a company. So I take it very seriously. Whether it's for 50 people or for one person, I try to make sure that the person is seen in the best light, and I never leave until somebody's happy, with their picture. I really want people to feel good about themselves, not just the experience, not about me, but I want them to, feel like they're proud to have that image represent them. So if somebody's just starting out, I think, for portrait photography, learn the technical parts of photography, but be comfortable around other people. And don't be afraid to be who you are, when you're photographing people.
I can't imagine saying it any better than that. So Rob, I gotta say, thank you so much for your time today. You've shared a ton about this world that I know nothing about. And I feel like I know just a little bit more today than I did yesterday. And for that, I want to say thank you. And I hope that the listeners feel the same way as well. And if they don't, then they just must have had it on mute or something and not listen the entire time. Because you did.
The entire time without sound. Oh, my God.
You shared a ton of great stuff. But before I let you go, can you let the listeners know where they can find you and your work anywhere online?
My corporate photography site is www.robtphoto.com, robtphoto.com, and it shows all the work I've done with celebrities and TV work, corporate work, individual portraits, editorial style, and there's even some still life on there as well. But there's some good celebrity stuff too. It's kind of fun. So, check that out, even just to see the celebrities. And then I the one business I don't advertise that I still do on referral is my family portrait and event site. And that's www.firstframesphoto.com, firstframesphoto.com. And there'll be weddings on there and newborn portraits, different lighting styles, different kinds of clients, but hopefully it speaks to my diversity.
I hope you enjoyed today's Rewind episode. Remember, photography is not just about creating art. It is about documenting the world around you as you see it. So go out right now and tell your unique story through your camera. Until next week, remember, the more that you shoot today, the better of a photographer you will be tomorrow. Talk soon.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review in iTunes. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.